one-off payment of more than $1,200 this year, and a 4.3% pay rise for most staff next year against a teacher's demand for a 9% rise. To the Minister of Education, Gillian Keegan, that was a fair and reasonable offer. To the teachers, who have seen a relative decline in their pay since 2010, it was an outrage.
Because we've had a pay freeze for loads of successive years since 2010, and then a few pay awards that were either below or in line with inflation, that's effectively another pay cut.
The government claims the rises will be covered by extra funding provided to state schools over the next 2 years.
The unions representing the teachers say this is not just about pay. As with other public sector disputes, they say it's about a lack of investment. It's about cuts to funding for schools, about teacher shortages.
Special education needs teacher Fiona Edwards recently told a special committee that gives recommendation to the government on teacher pay rises about how a lack of funding is impacting teacher recruitment.
I have 31 children with education, health and care plans, again, quite a bit above the national average. 11 of these children are in our autism unit. The autism unit ought to have 14 children, but at the moment we've only got 4 members of staff, not 5. We've been trying for a year to recruit a 5th member of staff, and until we do so, we can't have any more children in the unit.
The UK has been gripped by waves of public sector industrial action for months, brought on by double-digit inflation and a cost-of-living crisis. Despite the inconvenience caused by the strikes, public support for them remains strong.
I support it. I think the government should get back round the table and offer a decent pay increase so they can get back to work.
I think it's not surprising and absolutely inevitable, and I fully support the teachers.
And while the government twiddles its thumbs, there will be another strike on May the 2nd, once again keeping hundreds of thousands of teachers and students out of the classrooms. Site Purism, London.
South Korean President Yoon Suk-yeol visited the White House in Washington for a summit with U.S. President Joe Biden. The two celebrated the 70th anniversary of the U.S.-South Korea alliance and discussed responses to North Korea's nuclear and missile development, to which the U.S. leader issued a warning.
A nuclear attack by North Korea against the United States or its allies or partisans our partners is unacceptable and will result in the end of whatever regime were to take such an action.
President Yoon has sought to strengthen the alliance with the U.S. to include a stronger commitment to extended deterrence, the U.S. so-called nuclear umbrella, and the regular deployment of U.S. strategic assets, weapons which can deliver a nuclear strike.
Sustainable peace on the Korean Peninsula does not happen automatically. Our two leaders have decided to significantly strengthen extended deterrence of our two countries against North Korea's nuclear and missile threats, so we can achieve peace through the overwhelming superiority of our forces and not a false peace.
Under the new policy, U.S. nuclear submarines will make port calls in South Korea for the first time in 40 years. New U.S.-South Korea military activities were outlined in the summit communique, the Washington Declaration. It describes the formation of a nuclear consultative group for the U.S. and South Korea to better coordinate responses to North Korea's nuclear and missile developments. Meanwhile, peace activist leaders rallied in front of the presidential office in Seoul. They contend such aggressive U.S.-South Korea policies and resumed large-scale joint military drills only increase tension.
Only dialogue and negotiation can generate peace and denuclearization on the Korean Peninsula. The South Korean and U.S. authorities should immediately stop deploying strategic assets and practicing war and abolish expansionary deterrence policies. We must engage in dialogue with North Korea without conditions.
With Washington's blessing, President Yoon has also moved to participate in a trilateral alliance with Japan and the U.S., despite widespread public opposition. Frank Smith, Seoul.
In spite of the government's ongoing legal battle with the Supreme Court over elections, 180 lawmakers gave Prime Minister Shehbaz Sharif their full confidence in his ability to lead the country, granting him a vote of confidence from the National Assembly.
The National Assembly of the Islamic Republic of Pakistan reposes its full confidence in the leadership of Mian Muhammad Shehbaz Sharif as the Prime Minister of the Islamic Republic of Pakistan.
Sharif praised his party members and allies for their support after being elected last year with 174 votes to succeed Imran Khan, who was ousted in a vote of no confidence.
Parliament ne mujhe jo vote of confidence diya hai.
This parliament elected me as the Prime Minister. If this parliament reaches a decision after debate and obliges the government and cabinet, then it is mandatory for me to respect its decision. The judiciary does not have the right to rewrite the constitution. This is a violation of the law and the constitution.
The former Pakistani Premier Imran Khan, who has been attempting to force early elections, has suffered a major setback as a result of the governing coalition's show of power. Khan dissolved his party's local governments of the Punjab and the Khyber Pakhtunkhwa provinces in January in an effort to press the government for holding early elections. However, the ruling coalition turned down his demands despite intervention by the country's top court, arguing that the government is unable to hold elections in May due to shortage of financial resources and the country's deteriorating security situation. Khan's political party, PTI, believes that government is afraid of its possible defeat in the upcoming elections, and that's why it is using delaying tactics.
We want to get the country out of this chaotic situation through holding fresh elections. Our mission is to find a solution through these discussions, and we believe that whatever solution we propose will be in accordance with the constitution.
Meanwhile, following the directives given by the top court, both the government and the opposition started negotiations to set a time frame for holding fresh polls in the country.
Although the talks between the government and the opposition have been initiated on the directives of the country's top court, analysts say it is unlikely that these negotiations will yield any positive result, as the ruling coalition seems determined to complete its constitutional term, which will be ended in August this year. Nasir Kazmi, Islamabad.
A loss that can be never replaced. At the age of 69, Nader Talibzadeh succumbed to his heart disease at a hospital in the Iranian capital. Now, a year after he was laid to rest, the veteran Iranian movie producer, director, and researcher is revered as a champion and, in the words of leader of the Islamic Revolution Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, a revolutionary researcher and artist.
Talibzadeh believed that the Islamic Revolution is a light that should shine on the whole world. He believed that it is our job to spread the message of the Islamic Revolution. That is why he made so many documentaries.
It is with this mentality that Nader Talibzadeh founded the Ammar International Popular Film Festival in 2010. Talibzadeh's death has been widely grieved in Iran and across the region, where he was known as the face of resistance media.
The legacy of Nader Talibzadeh was, if I want to put it in like two or three words, to be the voice of the voiceless, to always support the oppressed people all around the globe, not in this country, not only in the countries in this region, but everywhere in the world. If you've seen his documentaries, if you've seen his programs on Press TV, on the other channels, and also on YouTube, he started a show on YouTube called Nader's Show. He spoke about everything in every part of the world. So his legacy is to always call for justice, to be the voice of the voiceless, and hopefully we will continue this path and we will hold on to his legacy.
During his fruitful career, Nader Talibzadeh directed, wrote, and produced numerous award-winning documentary films. Following a decade of research and historical documents based on the Holy Quran and the Bible, in 2007, he produced his first feature-length movie titled The Messiah. In this movie, he presented an Islamic perspective on Jesus and his teachings.
He was there whenever he was needed. His TV shows were aimed at raising public awareness, and in short, he was the voice of the Islamic Revolution.
His interviews with foreign guests on his TV shows were very educational. He used media to shed light on the unknown. He was a great teacher.
Most importantly, Talibzadeh served as the chairman of the International New Horizon Conference, an annual event that scrutinizes the hegemonic policies and war crimes of the U.S. and the Israeli regime. Together with his wife Zainab Mahana, they were blacklisted and sanctioned by Washington for organizing the conference.
The veteran Iranian journalist, TV producer, show host, documentary filmmaker, and director Nader Talibzadeh passed away a year ago, but his memory lives on, and he will always be remembered as one of the most influential cultural figures in Iran. Gisumish Ahmadi, Tehran.
The Embassy of Iran in Russia hosted a reception on the occasion of the Day of the Army of the Islamic Republic. A number of guests congratulated the representatives of Iran on the achievements in the industrial and defense sectors.
While some states bend to the diktats of the United States, Iran boldly acts as it sees fit. Iran has had significant military achievements. The areas of military technical cooperation have shown that Russia takes a lot from Iran, but it also means that Russia gives a lot to Iran. In the near future, the Iranian army will be much stronger in terms of combat aircraft, anti-aircraft systems, and other things. In addition, new opportunities have been brought forth regarding cooperation between Russia, Iran, and China.
Russian-Iranian relations have taken a new direction as the two countries are under similar Western pressure, which necessitates more cooperation between Tehran and Moscow. Recent quadripartite meeting of defense ministers of Iran, Syria, Russia, and Turkey in Moscow shows that cooperation is not limited to the military field, but it also covers other areas.
The trilateral cooperation between the three countries is very important for the stability in the region as well as in the whole world. We need to strengthen this cooperation because there is a kind of complementarity of interest between the three countries' policies. This is why each one of us need the two others. And we are not just friends. We became strong allies. So alliance means that you should take into consideration the interest of others. And this is exactly what's happening between the three of us.
In his speech, the representative of the Ministry of Defense of the Russian Federation noted that military cooperation between Russia and Iran is a fundamental element in the bilateral relations and is of a strategic nature.
The Army Day is celebrated in Moscow on a high level. Iranian embassy has organized a reception in honor of this day for many reasons. Now that Russian-Iranian military cooperation has reached a new grade, the reception is attended by important guests, ambassadors, politicians and military attaches. Marina Kartunova, Moscow.
This is IRIB English Radio.
IRIB English Radio. With you every single moment.
The supplication on Tuesdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, and praise is His right, since Him deserves it, abundant praise. I seek refuge in Him from the evil of my soul, for surely the soul commands to evil, except as my Lord has mercy. I seek refuge in Him from the evil of Satan, who adds sins to my sin. I seek protection with Him from every wicked tyrant and unjust sovereign and conquering enemy. O Allah, place me among Thy troops are the victors, and place me in Thy party, for Thy party are the ones who prosper. And place me among Thy friends, for Thy friends no fear shall be upon them, nor shall they sorrow. O Allah, set right for me my religion, for it is the preserving tie of my affair. Set right for me my hereafter, for it is the abode of my permanent lodging, and to it I flee from the neighborhood of the vile. Make life an increase for me in every good, and death an ease for me from every evil. O Allah, bless Muhammad, the seal of the prophets, and the completion of the number of the envoys, and his household, the good, the pure, and his household, the good, the pure, and his companions, the distinguished. And give me on the Tuesday three things. Leave no sin for me unless Thou forgives it, and leave no grief unless Thou takes it away, and leave no enemy unless Thou repelst him. By means of In the Name of Allah, the best of the names, in the name of Allah, Lord of earth and heaven, I seek to repulse every hateful thing, the first of which is His anger. And I seek to attract every lovable thing, the first of which is His good pleasure. So seal me with forgiveness from Thee, O Patron of Beneficence.
Now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Spotlight. I'm Prabhat Athwaite. The U.S. is continuing its militaristic approach towards nuclear-armed North Korea. In the latest offensive, U.S. President Joe Biden and his South Korean counterpart said Pyongyang would face the end of its leadership if it uses its nuclear arsenal. Why is the U.S. provoking North Korea, who has been on a rapid pace when it comes to developing nuclear weapons? China has reacted, warning Washington and Seoul against provoking confrontation with North Korea. In this edition of the Spotlight, we will look at how the U.S. in addition to China, is facing another standoff, namely with North Korea. First, let me introduce our guests for this edition of the program. Ken Hamon, professor of East Asian and Global History at New Mexico State University, joins us from New Mexico. Also joining us, Harley Schlanger, spokesman at the International Schiller Institute, who joins us from Potsdam, Germany. I'd like to welcome you both, and I'll first start with you, Ken Hammond, if I may. The President, Joe Biden, couldn't be clearer in terms of what he said. And let me quote him. Look, a nuclear attack by North Korea against the U.S. or its allies or partners is unacceptable and will result in the end of whatever regime to take such an action. It kind of reminds us of the will be met with fire and fury, or whatever that was that the U.S. President, former U.S. President Donald Trump said. Which one do you think is worse? Are they sending the same message?
Oh, I think they're definitely sending the same message. It's just a question of the selection of rhetoric. This kind of threat to North Korea. Of course, you know, the only reason that North Korea is investing its resources in its own nuclear program is to defend itself against the threat that the United States has constituted towards it for 50 plus years now, 60 plus years now, since the end of the war on the peninsula. You know, North Korea is in a very defensive position, and these latest actions by President Biden and, as you mentioned, President Trump before him, simply ratchet up the tensions and are part of, you know, America's aggressive stance trying to maintain its position in East Asia.
Yeah, and when you think that the tension is going to be higher, they keep increasing, Harley Schlanger. I mean, basically, Washington and Seoul have secured this deal, which is called the Nuclear Pact, from what we understand, which is the way it's been described, a periodic deployment of U.S. nuclear submarines to South Korea. Now, correct me if I'm wrong, Harley Schlanger, but the U.S. has said that it will not subscribe to having nuclear arms in the peninsula, especially in South Korea. But doesn't this constitute that, be it intermittently?
Well, I don't think you can go by anything that President Biden is saying. I agree with the other guest that what we're seeing is a reckless ratcheting up of tensions coming from Washington. And I would urge the people of South Korea to take a look at what Washington and NATO are doing to Ukraine by bringing the Ukrainians into the war that they're trying to wage against Russia. It's destroying that country. The idea that Biden is preparing for a nuclear response to North Korea, you know, this is at the same time that the Biden administration is accusing Putin of threatening to use nuclear weapons, which Putin is not doing. So you add to this that this represents an extension of NATO to the Pacific, the so-called global NATO, which includes the Australian, UK, US nuclear submarine deal. Now the South Koreans, the Japanese are being brought in, rearming Japan. This is all insane. It's based on a U.S. reaction against the fact that China has become a successful economic nation, and that's why it's being viewed as a threat. And I bring up this question of what's happening to Ukraine because while the U.S. is saying we're doing this for Ukrainian freedom and democracy, what's happening is they're killing off the people of Ukraine for the purposes of a NATO attempt to weaken or break up Russia. So the people of South Korea would be very wise to look at what's happening in Europe on the other side of the globe and realize having a promise from the United States such as this only means there's a likelihood of a war, which will be a catastrophe for the people of South Korea and of North Korea.
Okay. When our guest there, Ken Hammond, talks about how South Koreans should react to this and take a lesson from what's happening to Ukraine, it makes it sound like South Korea perhaps has sovereignty when it comes to its military doctrine. But correct me if I'm wrong, based on some of the research done here, the South Korea, in particular its military, does not really have a say when it comes to the way that it can react in its foreign policy arena unless the U.S. directs it or approves it. Isn't that correct?
Yes, that's exactly correct. The provisions of the relationship between the United States and the military in South Korea are that even in ordinary times, there's a tremendous amount of coordination. A lot of South Korean military personnel are rotated through assignments with American units so that they train together and their functioning is largely integrated. In the event that any kind of hostilities should occur, the command of the South Korean Army reverts to the United States. So in essence, the South Korean Army becomes simply an extension of American military power on the in the southern part of the peninsula. So the idea that that the South Korean military is in some way, you know, might be a counterbalance or something like that to American recklessness, I'm afraid is not that's not going to work very well. But I do agree that the you know the people of South Korea need to be very cautious about what their government is doing, and perhaps rethink the power that they have invested in Mr. Yoon, because he is obviously aligning himself quite closely with American interests, which are not necessarily at all the same as those of the South Korean people.
Yeah, and when you take a look, Harley Steiger, at the U.S., in particular, obviously, Joe Biden, have you detected any statements, any motions, or anything that's even rings any kind of diplomacy when it comes to North Korea? I mean, not even an ounce at this point, going on to almost 4 years now in his presidency. Why do you think he has not even made any effort to pursue down that path, just in statements, maybe not making a commitment, but just invoke some kind of a diplomatic overture to North Korea?
Well, I think that's characteristic of his overall policy. Whatever else Biden is, he is a puppet for the interests that are committed to maintaining the United States as the world hegemon, the unipolar order, what Blinken calls the rules-based order, which means the U.S. determines the rules. And countries like South Korea, Japan, Australia become subordinate to U.S. interests. But the idea is that the U.S. is trying to fight these wars with other people's armies. Now, in that context, when you talk about Biden and diplomacy, where's the diplomacy that could have avoided the war in Ukraine? He rejected it. So did NATO. Now the same thing is going on toward China and North Korea. Say what you will about Donald Trump, but he did try to talk to the North Koreans, and there was a brief moment before he unleashed the lunatic John Bolton. There was a brief moment where there was conversation going on with North Korea. There's none of that that we've seen from Biden, including back channels. There was a talk of a back channel which never, as far as I know, never really was activated.
Well, taking a look at what the South Korean president has said, Ken Hammond, it's interesting. He said Seoul will respond firmly to North Korean provocations, but will keep the door open for dialogue on North Korean denuclearization. This kind of sounds like it's dictating the way that were there to be any talks, North Korea should behave, which is the same error in the approach that the U.S. has made when it comes to North Korea. Why are they not open to negotiations when we're talking about North Korea's firing of these missiles, which has been ramped up in the past year, especially in the past 6 months?
Well, I think that North Korea's missile tests and whatever other military developments they're pursuing, as we've said before, you know, these are their defensive measures. You know, North Korea is threatened. You know, we have American troops in the southern part of the peninsula, where the ROK troops are there. Now the United States is talking about having nuclear submarines with atomic weapons on them, making port calls in South Korea. North Korea's obviously, you know, got to do something to try to keep the United States and its its projection there in South Korea from simply trying to get rid of it, trying to destroy it. That's the long-term objective, of course, is to get rid of the North Korean regime, get rid of the North Korean government, get rid of the North Korean state. So I think that you know, when the South Korean president, you know, makes a gesture of sort of saying, well, you know, we'll go along with the United States, but we also want to, you know, leave the door open for possible talks about denuclearization, and then agrees to having these port calls by American nuclear-armed submarines, you know, the contradiction there, it's just barefaced. I mean, it's just the way that they say one thing and do another thing. We see this in American, you know, political rhetoric and political actions a lot, that there's this verbal commitment to certain principles, and then the government acts in ways that are diametrically opposed to those. So I think that the reluctance to even you know, broach the idea of negotiation, of an engagement with the other side, just reflects the depth of the anxiety, the depth of the fear that American political elites have of losing their dominant hegemonic position. And I think they fear, you know, I suppose, starting down some slippery slope that's going to result in a further deterioration of their power. But I think that, it's a very dangerous attitude and posture to maintain.
Well, Harley Stanger, you talked about the former U.S. President Donald Trump, and you said whatever you think about him, at least he made an effort to speak to the North Korean leader, and that was a positive sign. But when it came down to it, wasn't there also openness, maybe, when it came to any type of sanction relief for North Korea, which appears to be one of the things that North Korea is not getting from the U.S. I think if we want to take a look at that, that is something that perhaps is an impediment. It's stopping any type of perhaps cooling down of North Korea and being more open towards any diplomatic and negotiated type of settlement for this.
Well, you're absolutely right about that. There's a complete hypocrisy. And I wasn't defending Trump. I was just pointing out that he at least had a discussion process. But you're absolutely right. If you want to have rapprochement with a country, you don't start by sending nuclear submarines in their backyard and talking about the willingness to use nuclear weapons to defend your ally in South Korea. The negotiations start by looking at what's the big problem there. North Korea has an economic crisis. It's had it for a long time because of its isolation. You don't solve that problem by making them more isolated, by rattling sabers at them and talking about deliberate action to ensure the protection of South Korea, which wouldn't need to be protected if there was a true rapprochement. I think the hypocrisy of the U.S. policy is now seen by virtually everyone. I'm surprised the South Koreans have been blind to it. You know, I'm not so surprised about the Japanese because they have a whole history of this. And the Australians, well, they're part of the Five Eyes. But most of the rest of the world is moving away from this kind of U.S. hegemon, unipolar order idea where the U.S. makes the rules and everyone else has to submit to them or be targeted for military action. So I think what Biden, you know, Trump, whatever he intended to do, he failed. Biden is not even willing to make a gesture. And I think that speaks very poorly for not just Biden, but the people around him, such as Blinken and Sullivan and Victoria Nuland and the old Clinton-Obama crowd like Susan Rice. All of them are part of the Democratic Party War Hawk faction. And that's not a solution to these kinds of problems.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Well, Ken Hammond, let's just say by some miracle, by something that perhaps the U.S. may do, North Korea is willing to think about getting into some kind of negotiations with the U.S. But when it thinks about getting into that diplomatic arena, there's a precedent that has been set here in the Islamic Republic. We're very well aware of what happens when you get into an agreement with the U.S. on a nuclear-related issue. All they have to do is take a look at that and say, why should we get into an agreement with the U.S. when this is what they have done? Doesn't that serve as a warning sign for North Korea? Were there to ever be a channel opened up that way?
Well, I think the North Koreans have their own experience with that as well. Back in the second Bush administration, there were actually some overtures. North Korea stepped away from some of its research, some of its nuclear development, and there was a program to sort of move forward with negotiations and with providing assistance for energy development and things like that. And the United States subsequently completely abrogated that, walked away from that, just dropped it like a hot rock. And so I don't know why the North Koreans, would have a lot of faith or trust in American diplomacy. It's been shown to be hypocritical, not just in the relationship with North Korea, but many times in the past. So, the dilemma, of course, is that North Korea would like to be able to, devote its resources to its own economic development, to improving the livelihoods of its people. But it is under constant, relentless pressure and threat from the South, from the United States, which requires it to maintain this military development. And, it's as a long-term strategy, of course, we've seen the United States use arms races in the past to wreak havoc with the Soviet Union. So this idea of kind of just keeping the pressure on relentlessly and constantly provoking the North, it's designed eventually to bring about some kind of breakdown or some sort of systemic change. So I think that North Korea is entirely reasonable in learning from their experience and learning from the experience, as you mentioned, of the nuclear discussions with the Islamic Republic. The United States just does nothing but pursue its own self-interest or the self-interest of its ruling classes. And, North Korea has to make the best path that it can in navigating that situation.
All right, let's talk about China a little bit here, Harley Schlanger. And first of all, China has said all parties should face up to the crux of the Korean Peninsula issue and play a constructive role in promoting peaceful settlement of the issue. What's very interesting about China in terms of what the U.S. Has said regarding North Korea and also what the U.S. has asked Russia is that it has said both Russia and China should play a role in using their influence on North Korea for it to stop firing these projectiles. Why would China even entertain that thought when the U.S. is after China offensively, militarily? And I'm not going to say, of course, how the U.S. has been after Russia and the way that Russia has responded to this and China.
Well, the Russians and the Chinese know something about the intention of the ruling establishment in the United States. It's not to establish zones of peace and economic development. Everywhere the United States goes, as at the same with the situation before that with the British Empire, people are left impoverished. The idea of the United States is not to have economic development in these countries. If we wanted to, we could do that. And you're absolutely right, starting with ending the sanctions. Sanctions, in my opinion, are war crimes because the more people have been killed in some of these countries like Iraq by sanctions than by the actual war. And on this point you were making about the Islamic Republic and the U.S. treatment of Iran, look at Libya. Libya also ended their weapons of mass destruction program, and look what the U.S. did to Gaddafi. So there's no reason for North Korea to have trust and confidence in the United States. And now we're hearing the same thing from Putin. What Putin has said is there's no one to work with in the West. There's no one we can trust because of the level of betrayal. But that's the question of intent. And I think it's really important to understand that the leaders of the United States and both parties, the leaders of most of the political or the governments in Europe, have an intent to maintain the limited sovereignty of nations outside of their own circle. And that's something which is changing now. Countries are demanding the right to have economic development, an end to the colonial and neocolonial system. And the U.S. just keeps doubling down on insisting that we in the United States can make the rules and everyone else has to obey, or we have NATO or global NATO to enforce those rules. And that's not a winning proposition.
Curious to know whether the countries in that region, Ken Hammond, are on board when it comes to what the U.S. Japan and South Korea, for example, are doing when it comes to North Korea. I mean, surely these countries can't, don't want any type of military confrontation to happen here, especially when you're talking about a nuclear one, potentially. I'm sure they're not all on board when it comes to the U.S. move towards North Korea. Or are they? Or how do you feel the situation is like there?
Well, I think you know, there's a range of variation across the region. Some of the governments, and we have to be clear that these are decisions that are being made by governments in power in different countries. Some of the governments, Japan and at the present time South Korea, are aligning themselves closely with the United States. There have been large demonstrations in South Korea, also some demonstrations in Japan, expressions of protest against that alignment, against these new policies, against the rearmament in Japan. I'm sure that there will be concern expressed by many people in South Korea about these nuclear-armed submarine visits that are on the agenda now. I think if you look elsewhere around the region, you can see countries that are very anxious about the American role. Even a country like the Philippines, where you know they're having base agreements with the United States again, but there's considerable unease about American conduct. And when you get down certainly into Southeast Asia, Vietnam, Laos, Cambodia, Thailand, even Malaysia, Indonesia, these countries are very cautious in their attitude towards the United States. They don't want to totally alienate the United States. They don't want the United States to start seeing them as enemies, because that's a very dangerous proposition. But they're very clearly expressing their desire to find, you know, maybe a middle path, a way not to be aligned so closely with the United States, because they recognize that really the future in East Asia, Southeast Asia, and much of the world is the future of China's developing economy, China's developing, new society, and that the United States is trying desperately to hold on to a declining preeminence in the world, and that's a losing proposition, and I think countries are frightened by what the United States may do to try to protect that, and I think many countries are, and certainly many people, are very anxious about the state of play.
Okay, final question, Harley Shanker, in under a minute. So you have a checklist from the U.S., military exercises with regional allies, check. Now you have a nuclear-armed submarine, check. You have sanctions, check. What other things in the toolbox does the U.S. have that it may exercise that may cross that red line for North Korea?
Well, I'm not sure what would cross a red line for North Korea. The real issue here is that there is an opportunity for peace. This is the approach that the Chinese have been taking. This is what the G20, outside of the Western countries, the G20 is looking for a change in this. From the U.S. side, the only thing that I see that would change it is the fact that the U.S. can't afford a two-front war. And I mean, they can't afford it militarily or financially. And at some point, you're going to have to pay the piper. And, you know, I think it's more likely that the U.S. will cross its own internal red line. And hopefully some people in the U.S. will come to their senses and back away from this kind of confrontation.
Thank you very much, Harley Shanker, spokesman, International Schiller Institute. Ken Hammond, professor of East Asian and Global History at New Mexico State University. Thank you. With that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. Rami Kavitakwe and the team, it's goodbye.
The whole world is silent towards oppression, even one voice becomes powerful. IRIB English Radio, the voice of the voiceless. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en. in the limelight.
Slowly, a global coalition is shaping up to remove the use of US dollar from international trade. The days of the US dollar's hegemony appear to be numbered. We take a look at some of the world press and media's coverage of this issue. Please stay with us. Turkey's Anadolu news agency has covered this story and tells us more. The global trend of substituting the US dollar with local currencies in trade transactions is speeding up as more countries are ditching the greenback. On Wednesday, 26th of April, Argentina said it will pay for Chinese imports in Chinese yuan instead of US dollars to preserve its international reserves. In a meeting in Buenos Aires with China's ambassador, Zhu Xiaoli, Economy Minister Sergio Massa said Argentina will be able to program a volume of imports in yuan worth the equivalent of more than $1 billion from next month. The Argentinian Economy Minister Sergio Massa said the South American country will program a volume of imports in yuan worth more than $1 billion from next month, which will replace the use of US dollars. He said the decision to pay in yuan improves the perspective of Argentina's net reserves. It also allows us to maintain the level of activity, the volume of imports, the pace of trade between Argentina and China, and the levels of economic functioning that Argentina needs following a poor year for domestic agriculture, and thus exports, amid a persistent drought. The days of US dollars hegemony appear to be numbered, as multiple countries have adopted alternative currencies to the US dollar for international transactions. The US dollar's position as the primary global reserve currency is now being challenged. This is because several countries have started to ditch their dependency on the dollar and strengthen bilateral relations. This is a trend that is known as de-dollarization. Website teletrader.com has also covered this story. Recently, Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov said the transition to non-dollar currencies is unstoppable as more countries seek alternatives to the greenback. Sergei Lavrov said the flight from the US dollar as the medium of exchange in mutual payments in favor of national currencies is an irreversible trend in global trade. The Russian Foreign Minister added, "We're starting to see a flight from the US dollar. So far, it is not at all swift, but it is sure to accelerate. In fact, this trend is irreversible." The United States has already, for real, sawed off the tree limb that it was perched on, managing global financial flows and the world economy as a whole by leveraging the dollar's dominant role. Over the past months, several countries have announced a shift away from the US dollar in their international trade. Some South American and ASEAN countries have announced plans to reduce their reliance on the US dollar. The BRICS group, including Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa, is also mulling the possibility of creating a common currency. In February, the Central Bank of Iraq, a major oil supplier, announced that it will allow trade with China to be settled in Chinese yuan for the first time. That same month, members of the China-dominated Shanghai Cooperation Organization, the SCO, agreed to increase their trade in their local currencies. According to Robert Kiyosaki, author of Rich Dad, Poor Dad, the US will suffer devastating hyperinflation and war starvation as the BRIC countries decided to dump the dollar. The Islamic Republic of Iran has also abandoned the US dollar in its trade with China and Russia. Saudi Arabia, a key OPEC member, said it will completely give up petrodollars and will start accepting the Chinese yuan. Hindustan Times has also covered this issue and tells us more. India has finally joined hands with Bangladesh to do cross-border trade in their own local currencies, the Indian rupee and the Bangladeshi taka, making Bangladesh the 19th country to ditch the US dollar. After months of intense discussions and meetings, a delegation from the Reserve Bank of India and the State Bank of India visited Dhaka in Bangladesh to discuss and finalise the mechanism to engage in cross-border trade in local currencies. In order to set into motion the initiative, two of Bangladesh's biggest banks, Sonali Bank and Eastern Bank Limited, are expected to open accounts in two Indian banks, the State Bank of India and the ICICI Bank. According to news reports, the two Indian banks are also going to do the same by opening similar accounts with two Bangladeshi banks. According to bank officials, the opening of these new accounts, known as Vostro and Nostro accounts in global accounting, will require the approval of respective central banks. Out of the total worth of Indian exports to Bangladesh, $2 billion worth of exports are said to be traded in Indian rupees, and the rest will be paid in US dollars. Meanwhile, according to Indian media, exports from Bangladesh to India will be fully traded in rupee and Bangladeshi taka. The two friendly neighbours will do cross-border trade in rupee and taka without the inclusion of any third country, and hence would benefit from abandoning the US dollar in their exchange process. The Business Standard has also covered this story and tells us more. Afzal Karim, the Chief Executive Officer and Managing Director of Sonali Bank Limited, said bilateral trade with India in Bangladeshi taka and Indian rupee will reduce pressure on the US dollar. Both countries will benefit from this. Afzal Karim said more banks from the two countries will gradually join the process. Bangladesh Bank Executive Director and spokesperson Mesbul Haq said that the decision has been welcomed by business leaders in his country to settle trade with India in Indian rupees and Bangladeshi takas, as they think that the arrangement will promote trade and reduce pressure on foreign exchange reserves. Before Bangladesh, countries like Russia, Germany, the United Kingdom, Singapore, Sri Lanka, Oman, and 12 other countries already trading with India in local Indian currency, the Indian rupee. India has emerged as one of the international players to push the trend of de-dollarization globally and has over time accelerated its foreign trade with other countries in rupee. In 2022, India launched its own rupee trade settlement mechanism, allowing countries that don't have enough dollars or cannot trade in US dollars to trade in rupees. Previously, in early April, India signed an agreement with Malaysia that allows the bilateral trade to be settled in Indian rupees. Earlier in April, the new development bank, NDB, established by the BRICS group, decided to move away from the US dollar in international trade as it aims to introduce local currencies for its loans. In a bold move that has turned tables in geopolitics, the new development bank president, Dilma Rousseff, confirmed that the bank plans to provide 30% of loans in local currencies of its member nations effectively moving away from using the US dollar in international trade. Dilma Rousseff said during an interview on 14th of April, it is necessary to find ways to avoid foreign exchange risk and other issues such as being dependent on a single currency, such as the US dollar.
Comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.